crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome to Watch Jerusalem. The iconic story of young David's epic encounter with Goliath has captured imaginations for millennia. The classic underdog narrative really resonates with all people as we face insurmountable odds in our own lives. But is the history of David and Goliath, as well as the history of their respective nations, only figurative? Or is the history, as the Bible describes, a literal account of what took place? Well, on today's program, we're not so much going to look into the account of David and Goliath, but we are still going to study two cities that have everything to do with these two men. Two cities, one a Philistine city and another an Israelite city. Today we'll look at some of the more recent finds from the excavation seasons of Tel Esafi, identified with the Philistine biblical city of Gath, Goliath's hometown, of course. Then we'll look at a town about 10 kilometers as the crow flies from Gath, that of Kirbet Kaiapha, the site that over the past decade has caused a shock through the world of biblical archaeology. Welcome once again to Watch Jerusalem. Before we get into looking at some of those more recent discoveries at Gath and Kaiapha, it's worth discussing a little bit about the Philistines themselves as the Bible describes them. It's really easy to lump all the foreign nations that have dealings with Israel in the same category. We might call them the ites. The Bible mentions a lot of them: the Amorites, Perizzites, Amalekites, Jebusites, Canaanites. And what we need to remember is that these people are specific nations, specific peoples. Now, God had a different policy for Israel to have towards each of these. Now, there were some of these that when the Israelites were entering the promised land of Canaan, that God said he would wipe them out if they were obedient to him. Exodus 23 verse 23 says, "For mine angel shall go before you and bring you into the land of the Amorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Canaanite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, and I will cut them off." So this was going to happen to a number of those nations that were occupying the promised land that God had given, or that he had said he was going to give to the sons of Israel. But what about the other people, the other nations that weren't mentioned in that list? What about the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Philistines? What about those people? Well, God didn't intend Israel to wipe them out. In fact, for a lot of those people, God actually gave them their own land. Now, when you talk about the Israelites coming into the promised land in the 15th century BC, there were already nations surrounding that territory that they were meant to have dealings with. No, they weren't meant to intermarry with them. They weren't meant to follow after their customs and their ways, but they were meant to trade, to do business with them as well. God's purpose wasn't to destroy all nations and let Israel reign supreme all over the world. No, his purpose for Israel was to be a model nation and to have nations around them take note, learn, want to emulate Israel because of their relationship with God. In fact, many of these nations that God allowed to have territories around Israel were actually relatives of Abraham, if not related to his very own sons. You could talk about Lot's children as well, Abraham's nephew. They started the Moabite and the Ammonite nation. Edom was started by Esau, the brother of Jacob. So as we read through Genesis, we need to realize that when we're reading these stories about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the beginning of the Israelite nation, we're also reading about the beginning of these other nations that would surround the Israelites. And God had a plan and purpose in that. These were the next of kin of Jacob, and they would be the nations that would be surrounded Israel. and that was by God's intent. Now, what about these Philistines? They're the villain in the story of David, but obviously they were around for a long time previous to him. The Bible discusses even the Philistines as far back as Abraham's time, yet it seems that the Philistines came in mass a little bit later during the period of the time of the judges, and we see them come into the story with the judge Samson, and then following his judgeship, we see them featuring in Eli, the story of Eli, and also Samuel going into King Saul's reign and then into King David's reign. Now, when we mention the term Philistine today, it's really used in a derogative way to describe somebody that's uncultured, but that is really unfortunate as a lot of these excavations are bringing out, because the Philistines did have a high level of culture. Their pottery was some of the most refined in the region. Yes, they were pagans. They did follow after other gods. They didn't follow after an Israelite god. But these people were a well-developed civilization. When you think about it, they did trade with Israel through a number of periods, but they also represented the greatest military threat that Israel would face for a number of years. Of course, once Israel was taken into captivity by the Assyrians and then Judah by the Babylonians, they were the people we think about mostly about being military powers, and even the Egyptians to the south. But really, through a few hundred years around the beginning of the monarchy period, Saul's reign and David's reign, it was the Philistines who were the greatest military threat, direct threat at least, for Israel. So the Bible does talk about the Philistines at great length. And really, if we were going to look at this period, if we left God out of the picture and were just a political observer looking at the time of King Saul just before King David, and you saw the Philistine nation right next door to the Israelite nation or Israelite people, you'd be hard-pressed to pick which of these two powers was going to come out on top. In a lot of ways, they were equals until the kingdom of David, or the kingship of David. Now, there was a real constant struggle between the Israelites and the Philistines, and really, without God's intervention, it could have been that the Philistines might have actually wiped out the Israelites. But obviously, we know that didn't happen. So who were these Philistines? Now, the ultimate origins of the Philistines is slightly obscure. We don't really know exactly where they came from. The Bible does mention, though, the place which they sprang from to reach Canaan, or where they were stopped in at. Now, this could have been their original location, or it could have been just a stepping stone on their travels. But both Amos chapter 9 and verse 7 and Jeremiah 47 and verse 4 talk about these Philistines coming from the Isle of Kaphtor. And Mesopotamian sources call Kaphtor or Kaphtara. They say it's associated with the island of Crete. So the Philistines came from that island before they came into Canaan. And it looks like they moved en masse to Canaan around the year 1200 BC, about 200 years before the time of David. If we look at the civilization on Crete, their rich culture pretty much collapsed at that time. Now, there is some sort of connection between the collapse of the Minoan culture and the partially Greek culture on Crete and the arrival of this type of culture in Canaan as well. And it's quite interesting. A lot of the archaeological discoveries from the Philistine cities, we would expect to find more Canaanite types. Well, just naturally would expect to find more Canaanite type vessels and things. But what we do find is the influence of the Greek culture on these people, because that is where they came from. Now, these people, they rose to power and they dominated Israel for the decades preceding the arrival of King David on the scene. In fact, it was likely the oppression of the Philistines that really motivated the Israelites, who had been ruled by a series of judges that God had raised up in time of need, to ask for a king to rule over them. It was likely the Philistine oppression that motivated them to do that. A king would present a dynasty of leaders for Israel, so they wouldn't have to wait on God to provide them the Savior. They wouldn't have to wait on him to provide deliverance. There would always be a dynasty that would be able to protect them. Well, King Saul, the first king of Israel, he was a Benjamite, he wasn't too successful at battling the Philistines. And that's the historical setting for the story of David and Goliath. That comes a number of years before David was even made king, when the Philistine threat was really the greatest. And of course, with David's defeat of Goliath, we notice in that story that, you know, while many in the Philistine army were defeated, the Philistines carried on to be a power. They did. In fact, by the time you get to the start of David's reign, ruling over Israel and Judah, you have the Philistines allowing Israel to live up on the mountainous region above them, and yet the Philistines maintaining garrisons, outposts, right up next to, or amongst the Israelites, Bethlehem, Gibeon, cities right in the middle of Israelite territory, had garrisons in them that were controlled by the Philistines. The Philistines kept a close eye on the Israelites through the period just before David. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 19 to 21 indicates that they, the Philistines, had a monopoly on the use of iron as well. Israelites were banned from having these weapons. And if they wanted to sharpen a farming implement, they had to go down to a Philistine town to get them sharpened and pay an exorbitant price to do so. That is the oppression, the type of oppression that the Israelites lived under during David's upbringing. He would have grown up under Philistine dominance for much of his life. And throughout Saul's kingship, they were under the Philistines. Now, things did begin to change after King David was made king. Following Saul's death, you'll remember that there was a period of bitter infighting within the Israelite people, or nation, if we can call it that. There was a 7.5 year period of bitter infighting. The southern tribe of Judah, they anointed David king. Just Judah anointed David king as soon as King Saul was dead. And yet the northern tribes anointed Saul's son, Ishbosheth, and we'll talk a little bit about that name a little later on in the show. They anointed him king over the remaining tribes of the north. And he would reign there for 2 years until he was killed. But then there would be another 5 years of borderline civil war between Israel, the nations in the north, and Judah, the kingdom in the south. Instead of coming together to fight against the common threat of the Philistines, they remained segregated and divided. And the Philistines were no doubt very aware of this infighting, and they were likely happy about it. But what happened after Ishbosheth's death and a number of years of civil strife, Israel finally became united under one king. David became king not only of Judah, that which he was for 7.5 years, but Israel as well. Now, it's important to get this backstory, and it's one that is overlooked a lot when we read the Bible, just the division that existed within Israel, and then how the Philistines viewed that division, and why they thought that as long as Israel was divided between Israel and Judah, that Israel and Judah are no threat to them. So I want to read a passage here, and it has everything to do with why the Philistines started to attack David, and then why David had to deal with them. As soon as David was made king, David didn't go out to fight the Philistines. The Philistines were worried, and they came to get him. This is 2 Samuel chapter 5 and verse 1 to 5, and I'm going to read this from the Jerusalem Publication Society, their English version. They said this, "Then came all the tribes of Israel to David unto Hebron." So notice this, when you see the word Israel here, we have to decide from the context whether it's meaning everybody in Israel, all the 12 tribes of Israel, 13 tribes of Israel, or is it just meaning the northern tribes that up to this point, their leadership had decided to not align with David? And no doubt they're coming to Hebron. Why? Hebron is the capital city of the tribe of Judah. So then, I'll continue reading. "Then came all the tribes of Israel," those northern tribes, "to David unto Hebron, and spoke unto him, saying, quote, your bone and your flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you that did lead out and bring in Israel. And the Eternal said to you, David, you shall feed my people Israel, and you shall be a prince over Israel." So they're quoting what was told David even while King Saul was king over them. Verse 3, "So all the elders of Israel came to the king to Hebron," which where David was, "and the king David made a covenant with them in Hebron before the Eternal, and they anointed David king over Israel. So this is an amazing point here, that up to this time you had this civil war, this infighting in the nation of Israel, like all of Israel, including Judah, and now David is made king finally after 7.5 years of him just ruling over the south. Finally, the northern tribes want him to be king. And what does he do after he's made king? Well, he goes to work right at the beginning and enacts a brilliant initiative to unite Israel and Judah. And that, of course, revolved around the capture of Jerusalem, the city of Jebus, and setting up that as a new capital for a new united people. But let's skip down to verse 17 and 18 of 2 Samuel chapter 5 and notice which people were keenly aware of what was happening in Israel and Judah at that precise time. This is just after, you can check out the chronology in 2 Samuel 5. It talks about David being made king over Israel and Judah. It talks about him taking Jerusalem. And then what do we get? Verse 17. And when the Philistines heard that David was anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to seek David, and David heard of it, and he went down to the hold. So notice here that the Philistines weren't worried about Israel and Judah when they were fighting one another. They didn't consider Israel a threat, and indeed, Israel and Judah weren't a threat. But as soon as David united the people, moving the capital to Jerusalem, this was something the Philistines could not allow. They realized this and they needed to squash the Israelites before they were able to unify in full strength. So they marched on Jerusalem. So they set themselves in the Valley of Rephaim, Emek Rephaim, this main street right here in the German colony in southern Jerusalem, right where I live. That's where they came out to fight against this new united Israel and Judah under David. That's how worried and concerned they were that there was now a united monarchy. Now, why would they come and fight against Israel and Judah when David was made king if David was a petty tribal chieftain? If really the southern kingdom of Judah was nothing and it was all the northern kingdom of Israel that was big and strong? Well, obviously the Philistines knew more than the biblical minimalists today, and they understood that Israel under David, with its new capital in Jerusalem, would become a threat that they needed to deal with immediately. But of course, we know what happened in the biblical story. David would deal with the Philistines. However, he wouldn't destroy them. He would let them live, living on the coast, but only after they accepted David's rule over them. With that background in mind, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss two cities that have everything to do with this period of King David and the uniting of Israel and Judah. We're going to look at the Philistine city of Gath, and 10 kilometers away, we're going to look at the Israelite city of Kirbet Kayafa, specifically as it relates to the time of King David. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuchtigal. First, we're going to look at Tel Esafi, which this has been largely recognized for a number of years as biblical Gath. And at first, there were a number of disagreements in the scholarly community where Gath was actually located. And yet now it seems that this has reached consensus that this is biblical Gath. This is just a massive ancient mound or tel, as they're referred to both here and in the Bible. And it's substantially bigger than any really Israelite tell from that same period, from the early part of David's rule. So it's quite large. Now, unlike many of the other nations that were surrounding Israel, the Philistines were neither absorbed into the kingdom of Israel or exiled anywhere else. They were allowed, as we covered earlier, to continue living in their home territories, and there were five major cities of the Philistines, and they're mentioned in the Bible, of course, as well. But one of those cities was this city of Gath, and really nowhere in the Bible is there any mention of Israel destroying this city, not until 200 years after King David. until around the time of the reign of Uzziah. Now, the biblical city of Gath has been excavated extensively over the past 100 years, and specifically over the last few decades, by a team led by Professor Aaron Meyer of Bar-Ilan University here in Israel. And they just have a wonderful blog, I think, of their excavations. And I would really encourage you to go and look at that blog. It gives you a really good, realistic idea, really, of the work that an excavation entails. It'll show you, it does look like a good time on excavation, but also show you the amount of work that goes into it as well. And so I would check out that blog, and I'll leave that in the show notes here below below this show, so you can read up on that. So again, this was a really important city. This was Goliath's hometown, probably one of the biggest of the Philistine cities, if not the biggest. And this was the town, again, of that giant that David did slay. Now, if you do see a video, a sensationalist video on YouTube, talking about the discovery of Goliath's skull, then that's probably not the case. It's not that true that they, well, not true at all that they have discovered that as yet. But about 10 years ago, they did find a really interesting inscription there on that excavation relating to Goliath, or at least that name. This inscription was found inscribed on a piece of pottery that's typical from that time period just after King David, and it became known as the Goliath inscription. Now, there were some pretty amazing headlines when it came out that Goliath of the Bible has been found. And yet when you talk to the excavators there and the archaeologists there, they're not trying to claim that Goliath was found. And yet they are. What they are saying is that they did see in this inscription a name, or a couple of names, that are Philistine names, yet the characters are written in Semitic script. There, it's the first, the earliest deciphered Philistine inscription using these Semitic letters that has ever been discovered. Now, I'll have to rely on their analysis. I'm not an expert at all on ancient languages, but he goes on, even you can see, Mr. Meyer does, and on the blog, you can even go in to see that, this post yourself. But he talks about how there are two names that appeared on this sherd, or the shard, and these are the letters, if we're going to anglicize it, A-W-L-T and W-L-T, and etymologically, they're extremely close to Goliath, those names. Extremely close to Goliath, or Eliath, something like that. And this isn't proof of Goliath, but it does definitely demonstrate that the names that were in use at the time that the Bible says Goliath was alive, and a bit thereafter, they were names that are extremely similar to Goliath. They were the same, used at the same time in the biblical narrative. And that's important. That's very important for that to be discovered, because we don't find that name or that type of name elsewhere later on in the biblical story. We find it right during the attack with King David. And then around in Gath, right where this Goliath came from, we find names inscribed on pottery bearing a striking resemblance to that giant's name. Now, if we look at another recent discovery from that city, we'll have to talk about the massive city wall and city gate that they've discovered over the past couple of years. Over the decades of excavation, they hadn't found this gate. And of course, gates are really important. You look at through the Bible, and gates are where a lot of meetings are done, a lot of business transactions are made. Obviously, you'll have some of the important members of the city that are there, the elders of the city. They make judges or they judge cases there at these gates as well. And this isn't really just talking about a single gate that you might think of with one entrance and goes in and out, and a door that swings in and out or goes up and down. There are multiple chambers to these gate complexes, really, where a lot of interesting work took place. Now, they've been looking for this gate for a number of seasons, and they only just found the very top of it back in 2015 and further excavated it in 2016. And this mayor claims that this gate is the largest ever found in Israel from this period. It's that big. Now, this is something that you would expect to find, because The Bible says that this was one of the chief cities of the Philistines, and that the Philistines dominated Israel through this period. And yet you'll read a lot of people that talk about this discovery saying, wow, this is totally different to what the Bible describes, that there would be this huge city gate from this biblical period. And yet the Bible describes the Philistines being a substantial people. No doubt this gate, you know, was in use for quite a long period of time. And they have dated it to the 10th century, I believe, or 10th century, continuing on in use after that time. So this gate does exist and does testify to a large Philistine people, which is what the Bible does say. And that's why we wanted to cover that introduction there at the beginning to talk about the Philistine nation and what the Bible actually says about them. Not what we think the Bible says about them, but what the Bible actually says about the Philistines. Now, what happened at this gate? And this is where it gets pretty exciting. In 2 Samuel chapter 21, through this period, King Saul is reigning, and David is on the run from Saul. Saul is trying to kill David, and David ran off at this time to Gath, to Philistine territory, and he made it all the way to this same city gate that has been recently uncovered. And again, I'll leave some links down to stories about this so you can see it yourself, see some pictures of it. Again, this is just the top of it, or really it's not the top of it, it's the very bottom of it that they've found. It's not preserved. I was listening to an interview from the archaeologist there the other day, and he said at some places it's preserved up to 2 meters, but you probably won't see pictures of that as yet. But it has been discovered, and this is what took place there after David was on the run from King Saul. This is 2 Samuel chapter 21, and we'll read from verse 11 onwards. It says, "And David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul, and went down to Achish, the king of Gath," or king of Gath. "And the servants of Achish said unto him, Is not this David, the king of the land? Did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? I think it's interesting there. That's a popular refrain that the Israelites did sing after David started to destroy a lot of the Philistines. And they sang, Saul has slain his thousands and David has slain his 10,000s. And yet that refrain has made it all the way to Philistine territory. And they see David coming into this city. Obviously, he didn't want to be recognized, yet he couldn't help it. He was recognized by these servants of Achish. And David," I'll read verse 13, "Now when David laid up these words in his heart, and he was sore afraid of the king of Gath." So what does he do? Verse 14, "He changes his demeanor before them and feigned himself mad in their hands and scribbled on the doors of the gate," of this very gate that has come up out of the ground the last couple of years here at Tel Asafi, "and let his spittle fall down upon his beard." So he feigned like he was mad. Then Achish said unto his servants, "Lo, when you see a man that is mad, wherefore do you bring him to me? Do I lack madmen, that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" And that was it. So David successfully here pretends that he's mad. And before the king is upset that his servants have brought him, after seeing him in the gate, have brought him before the king, and David is allowed to escape at that point. Now, the wood from those doors, obviously of that gate that had David scribble on them, that's long since deteriorated, but not those stone walls. Not those stone walls where those wooden gates were attached to. That massive gatehouse still exists in Gath, and it's there to be seen for all of us. Now, as I was saying earlier, just about 10 kilometers from Gath is this mound known as Kirbet Kayafa, this really important place that was right on the borderland between Philistine and Israelite territory. And when we come back, we're going to look in close detail at the recent discoveries from that township, from that fortress, really, and see how it matches up with this biblical period of King David.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. KPCG is supported by the Philadelphia Church of God. The PCG produces thetrumpet.com, a news website analyzing current events and Bible prophecy. Thetrumpet.com includes daily updates, analysis, and a unique perspective based on the Bible. More information is available online at thetrumpet.com.
This is Watch Jerusalem on KPCG.fm. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. Just this past week, my family and I had this chance to visit the Bible Lands Museum here in Jerusalem, just across the road from the Israeli Museum, because there was an exhibit we wanted to see. It's called In the Valley of David and Goliath, and it was a new exhibit that details the excavations of Kibbutz Kayafa over the past almost a decade that they have been working there. And I'm going to attach a link to the app that they've created for this tour. It's a way that you can go through the exhibit by yourself, and it's got commentary attached to it as well, and it's got some pictures to it as well. It'll probably take you about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes to go through it. If you wanted to download that and do that, I would recommend it, just because it is so new, all these discoveries coming together. This is not, again, an excavation that has been around for a long time. It's only begun back in 2006, and it details some of these stunning artifacts from the time of King David specifically. Now, this site of Kibbutz Kayafa, it's located between the ancient cities of Socho and Azekah, right on the border, as I was saying before, between the Philistines and the Judeans, or really the Philistines and the Israelites, we could say, during David's time, because David is the one that unified the nation. And again, it's the place of the battles between David and Goliath. It's the place that right by where David would have run to the king of Gath to try and seek some refuge there from trying to escape Saul as well. Well, carbon 14 at this site, the dating of this site, as well as the pottery there, has really shown that it did exist towards the end of, it was created right at the end of the 11th century and the early 10th century BC, this very time of King David. And that's extremely important, because up until this time, we haven't really found in Israel a specific site that we could say definitively was from the period of King David. Obviously, when normally cities are built, you have a builder, but then the builder will die and the city will continue in use. So you will get the material culture not only of the original person that constructed it, but you'll also get the material culture of those that lived there thereafter. With this site, it was only in use for a very short amount of time, and that time being the time of King David. We'll go into why we believe that is the case and why the excavators there even believe that is the case in this next section. This city was not really a city. It was a fortified site, but it's not, I wouldn't call it a city. I would call it a town. It was deliberately planned and constructed in a manner that really does predate a lot of the other cities in this region. And yet it is significant in it. The architecture does match a lot of the Israelitish architecture rather than the different Philistine sites that are near it. Now, there have been a couple of gates that were discovered at this site, which did lead the archaeologists there to label it as Sha'arim, which literally means two gates in Hebrew. And if you look back the story of David and Goliath in 1 Samuel 17, it talks about how when the Philistines escaped after Goliath was killed, they went by the way of Sha'arim, by this place that had two gates. And since they found two gates there, they have labeled it Sha'arim. I don't think it's too important whether that is the name of the place or not, because it doesn't change the fact that this was a city that existed during the reign of King David. Now, I went and visited this site back in 2012, right towards the conclusion of the excavations there. We were toured the site by a good friend and an archaeologist that works there from Hebrew University, Haggai Cohen Clonimus. And he's done a lot of work there over the years underneath Yossi Garfinkel, the head archaeologist there. And he gave us a very detailed view of the site, especially in light of where it fits in the current argument around the period of David and Solomon. We've talked previously on this show that there is this debate as to King David and Solomon's existence and how grand they were, whether they were the same as what the Bible says or not, whether they existed or not. And this site, probably more than any other, does more to dispel the myth that David and Solomon were petty tribal chieftains. You see, if this is a city or a town or a fortress built by King David, it's right there on the border of the territory. It's far from Jerusalem. It's far from Hebron. Miles, miles, miles away. And yet they had the ability to construct this site. Now, again, this is a really important that it is a single period site. And that means that it existed for a brief period of time, and then, in this case, it was abandoned and wasn't occupied for another 600 years. Now, as to the reason it was abandoned, we don't really know. It would seem pretty obvious to me that if this city was built as a fortress on the borderlands between the Philistines and the Israelites, we know once David did conquer them that the relations between the Philistines and the Israelites weren't that bad. And maybe they fell out of use, a reason to have a fortress in this borderland that would no longer be the borderland between the extent of David and Solomon's kingdom, because that kingdom did go all the way to the sea. The Philistines were actually part of it, though they weren't part of Israel proper. They were underneath that rule for a time. Now, before the discovery of this site, again, its first season was back in 2006. We didn't really know what the material culture looked like related to King David. We had the Tel Dan Stele back in the early 90s that told us that David was an actual historical figure, that he had a big dynasty, big enough so that the king of Syria bragged about defeating an Israelite king over 100 years after David had already died. So we have that, so that we know that David existed. Then we have King David's palace, originally discovered in 2005. But the material remains at King David's palace are actually quite scant. The reason for calling it King David's palace is not because it's overflowing with King David era pottery and material culture. It's more because the location fits the biblical description of where it should be. The very fact that it's massive and it's just outside the city walls of the Jebusite city and it's built on fresh ground, and that the window for construction date fits right around King David's time, shows us that this is likely King David's palace, and that's why it was identified as King David's palace. But it wasn't, you couldn't say that we found there just a barrage of King David era artifacts. So what does David's time pottery look like? Because again, pottery is the most important dating tool in archaeology because it changes so often and it's everywhere. And nobody bothers to pick it up a lot of the time. They just leave it where it breaks. So you know that it broke during the period probably that it was in use. But nobody could really say this is King David era pottery. But then the discovery of Kirbet Kaiapha comes along, where we have the first time really to truly understand the pottery styles specifically from the time of King David. This allows us to be able to more specifically relate future discoveries to the time of King David because of what they've found there. Now, these excavations, they were conducted, I think it might have been 2006 or 2007 it started, going through to 2013, led by Yosef Garfinkel. He works for the Hebrew University together with Saar Gano from the Israeli Antiquities Authority and Professor Michael Hazel of the Southern Adventist University of Tennessee. And they've been working there for a long time. And just the amount of artifacts that they've found from this period is really helpful for the future discovery of similar artifacts, whether it be in Jerusalem or elsewhere. Really more important than the specific finds, though, of this site is the fact that we have an excavation, we have a town right on the edge of the outskirts of Judea during the time that the Bible describes the wars with the Philistines. That's what's important rather than the individual finds, though they are significant as well. So how do we know that it's from King David's time? First of all, you'd need to prove that it's from the era that he existed, and then you would need to prove that it didn't belong to anyone else, that it wasn't a Philistine or a Canaanite city. as far as the dating goes of this site, this discovery of the site really came at the worst possible time for biblical minimalists, as they had just been espousing their theory of low chronology that said that all the pottery that historically we dated from the time of King David and King Solomon was actually from 75 plus years later. Those minimalists also said that the urbanization of the southern kingdom of Judah, this area where Caiaphas would be, really only developed around the 8th century BC, 200 years after King David. Well, what happened? Kibbutz Caiaphas was discovered, and carbon 14 dates along with, in the same strata as that, as those pottery shards, which are very similar to iron 2 as well, but they have some more specific features to it. Those carbon 14 dates match really well to the time of King David. This is what Yossi Garfinkel wrote in 2012. He said, "Minimalist approaches flourished over the past 30 years, claiming that there is no archaeological data for fortified urban centers in Judah from the 10th to 9th century BC. And thus, the Judaite monarchy could have developed only by the late 8th century BC. However, the radiometric data from Kibbutz Caiaphas clearly indicate that the process of state formation and urbanization started in the Kingdom of Judah as early as the 11th century BC. Even if one hesitates to equivocally accept the historicity of the Golden Age of the United Monarchy, talking about David and Solomon, it does appear that the kingdom was established in Judea at that time." So he's saying, from the carbon samples that we took next to this pottery, we know that it was from that time. And even the biblical minimalists, they would agree now with that, that yes, it is from that time. So then what are they going to do? Well, they have to say it's a Philistine or a Canaanite city. Well, how do we know it's an Israelite city then? That's a good question. We should prove that. Well, there's just a couple of points I'm going to rattle through here. We know that it's an Israelite city, one, because the city's architecture is very similar to the other cities in Judah. It's very different to that of the nearby Philistines, or the northern tribes of Israel even as well. Houses were built, were constructed along the city walls, just like in other Judaite cities. Then, in the six seasons of excavation, or seven now, seasons of excavation, there have virtually yielded no pig or dog bones. Now, pig or dog bones are very common at Philistine sites. Around 10 to 15% of all bones in Philistine sites in those cities are from pigs, dogs, or what are considered unclean animals. It's rare, extremely rare, to find pig and dog bones, especially pig bones, in Israel and Judah because they are unclean. And here we have Caiaphas with no pigs or dog bones right next to Philistine territory. So it's very unlikely that the Philistines then inhabited it. Then if you talk about the pottery at Caiaphas, it's clearly not Philistine, even though Gath, as we said, is just a few miles away. It bears closer resemblance to Israelite and Judean ceramics. And then we also have a discovery in 2008 there at Caiaphas, which is a really early inscription that is believed to be Hebrew. Now, we don't know exactly what it says. There's a number of different varying readings of it, but we definitely know that it is Semitic and not the Indo-European roots of what you'd expect from the Philistines. So we know that this site is an Israelite site. Then they also had another inscription back in 2012. This one they could read beautifully. Now this mentions actually the name of or has the same name as a Hebrew king. You'll remember that at the beginning of the show, we talked about how Saul, King Saul, before David, had a son who ruled for 2 years, and his name was Ishbosheth. Well, that's the name that the book of Chronicles gives him, and Chronicles is obviously written to after the exile. So after 500 BC is when it was written. But the book of Samuel, which details a similar history, doesn't call him Ishbosheth, calls him Ishbal, or Eshbal. And that is a name that fell out of use because no longer anyone wants to call their children after Baal. But this inscription wasn't the Ishbal, son of Shaul or son of Saul. It says Ishbal, son of Beda. But what's interesting, though, is that this name at this site that we know is from David's time features a name of a person that is exactly the same as the name of a king during David's time as well. Now, up until 5 years ago, these inscriptions are important because up until 5 years ago, there wasn't one inscription dating to the 10th century, to David's time. Now we have two from Kibbutz Kayafa, one discovered in Bet Shemesh, and the other one from the Ophel excavations here in Jerusalem that we had a part in finding back in 2012. It shows that writing was far more widespread than previously thought. Now, if you believe in your Bible and you believe that David wrote Psalms and you believe that other people had the ability to read and understand the law, then you would have had to know that writing was more widespread. And now we have these inscriptions that are slowly beginning to, well, not really slowly, they're being discovered at a fast rate right now. So if you go back to Kayafa, we have a large fortress overlooking the valley where David and Goliath fought. It's built during David's time. It's occupied by people who built like Israelites, who ate like Israelites, and had a culture like Israelites. And next door to that, we have another city, a larger city, inhabited by the Philistines, with Semitic writing featuring a name similar to Goliath, and with a massive gate that King David is described as in the Bible as retreating to from King Saul. Now, I would say we have here with these two cities, a city of the Philistines and a city of the Israelites, a pretty good alignment of text, biblical text, and archaeology. And to think that all of these discoveries were made in the past decade, to think what will be discovered in the next few years really gets me excited. That's about all we have time to cover today, but we'll try and keep you posted about other archaeological discoveries that are made here in Israel, with articles posted on watchjerusalem.co.il. If you would like to follow us, you can do that by following us at Twitter at watch_Jerusalem. Please like our Facebook page as well. Or you can send your feedback by email, of course, at letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Or you can write to our P.O. Box here in Jerusalem, P.O. Box 8314 Jerusalem, Israel 91082201. Thanks again for listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.